Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Well, we have a very exciting and special episode planned for today. We've got an exciting guest. This was actually not planned, as you know, if you listened to last week's episode. We were trying to get into things that you should do in the off season and all the things you have to do to get prepared for the upcoming spring. And, you know, if you've got any borrowed equipment or if anybody gave you something free or you were at a yard sale and found a good deal on something, we were going to talk about all those things. But I had a unique opportunity to catch up with a gentleman whose videos I've watched on YouTube for years and whose content I've enjoyed for a long time. And I know thousands of other people have as well. So, folks, without further ado, I want to introduce you to Ian Stepler of Stepler Farms. Well, Ian, hey, thank you so very much for agreeing to be on the podcast today. As I've told you before, I'm a big fan of your YouTube channel, Canadian Beekeepers Blog. Been watching that for several years. And in fact, I've mentioned your channel on the podcast several times. So we're very excited to have you today.
Yeah, well, thanks, Jeff. I'm happy to be here, too.
Well, hey, if you would, if you can just take a couple of minutes here, just give us a little bit of a background on, you know, how you got started in beekeeping, how long you've been doing it, what made you to kind of transition to commercial if it wasn't already a family thing, just anything you think might be useful to kind of give us some background on you and your operation.
Sure. I think beekeeping, it might have come natural to me, but my story maybe kind of originates like a lot of beekeepers I hear and how they got into beekeeping. And that's just kind of I stumbled into it. Our family isn't, never has been involved with beekeeping. We're a farm family, cattle and grain farm, and the farm's going to have the centennial here this year. So we've been here for quite a while, very well established, but I don't have that background. I would be the first generation beekeeper, so we don't have that inherent beekeeping history within our family. So it's kind of new to the farm. I kind of got hooked with the beekeeping craft back when I was in university and the diploma of agriculture, and just kind of stumbled into this beekeeping course they offer at the university. Bought four hives, and that was 1999. And built up to 30 hives, lost them all except for one, and then reinvested into the business and kind of built it into part of the farm makeup itself. Just as the farm grew and as my brothers come back to the farm to help manage operations, allowed us to focus on the grain, the cattle, and expand the bee farm. So it's been a good complement to the farm, growing from those four hives up to, I have 1,616 colonies in my winter shed right now. So it's become quite an obsession and my full-time job, really.
Wow. That's 1,660. So when it comes around time to, like springtime and you're coming out of the winter and you're ramping things up, I mean, obviously you have a certain percentage of dead outs and those that didn't make it through the winter, but what's your like spring full strength numbers? I mean, I'm assuming, you know, you break off some nukes and you keep a few, you know, create some additional production colonies, but do you kind of, hover in that 1600 range or does it keep growing every year?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You'll notice when you talk to most commercial beekeepers, they don't really know how many hives they have. And there's a reason, like when I was a hobby beekeeper, when I was a smaller operator growing, I knew, like, you said, how many hives you have? Well, I have 151 and a half colonies, you know, because I knew exactly what I had and I had track of everything. But you get a lot larger, and especially when you implement practices of beekeeping like what I have, it's hard to really pin down exactly what you have because it's always in flux. You have your colonies going to winter. So right now is a good time to peg how many colonies I have because I have them counted because they're stacked in rows and everything. But once spring comes out, you start accumulating losses. You also start identifying hives that are failing. And then you start taking some of the hives that you built the previous year and incorporating them into the system to replace those dead outs. And it becomes just a revolving cycle. So how many hives do I have? I have 1,616 in there right now. Maybe through the worst part of spring before we start building again, it'll go down to 1,200 hives, and then we'll build it back up to 1,800 and 1,900 hives, and just kind of continual flux back and forth. I like to peg a number for easy math at 1,500. So it's just kind of very dynamic in that nature.
Yeah. Sure. No, that makes sense. Now, I'm assuming you probably do a little bit of everything. I know we had a good discussion earlier about some queen rearing and some of the things that Carrie's doing for you there in the shop. And, you know, in my mind, I always see, you know, okay, well, we're going to create our queens. We're going to set up new nukes. The nukes are going to support our production colonies. I know you do honey extraction, but are you doing like Stepler Farms, you know, honey where people drop by and you're doing retail sales of honey, or are you doing kind of bulk with it? What types of things, I guess, are you doing to sort of, you know, that comprise the whole business and everything that you do to make it, you know, what it is?
I'd say the main focus on our farm is strictly honey production. Like, we're not into any type of pollination opportunities out here. We do sell bees when we have surplus, but the main focus of the farm is basically just self-sustaining our operations. So most of our work goes into building the queens, building the nukes, and most of that is used to incorporate into our business just to help sustain the youth within their operations and such. When we do have surplus, we do sell queen cells and we do sell nukes. I have a bunch of nukes sold already, actually, because I'm anticipating a good spring. But we're just focusing on the operation itself, and we focus on the honey sales, which is bulk. So we do, you know, there isn't a beekeeper I know that doesn't sell honey out of the honey house. So we do quite a bit of honey house sales to neighbors and to the local retail store and that. But most of our honey is sold through Bee Made, which is a packer of Western Canadian beekeepers. So we sell our name. There's about 350 of us beekeepers together in a cooperative, and we sell all of our honey, 100% Canadian honey, underneath the Bee Made brand. So we sell about 25 to 30 million pounds of honey right across the country into the States, Japan, Caribbean, and that. Most of the honey, private label honey, in some of the big chain stores in Canada, I'd say a good portion of that is Bee Made honey. So we represent ourselves pretty seriously on the shelf. And I think it's doing pretty well. One thing about, I'll just kind of dive into just the marketing part of what we do. I'm selling my honey to a packer, but by selling my honey to a packer, which I am part of the cooperative, it just helps me keep that connection to my product in the drum, sold to the packer, onto the retail shelf. And it just adds another layer of connection to my product as it's being sold ultimately to the consumer. So it feels like my 350,000 pounds of honey I produce here every year, I feel like I'm able to market and follow the honey right to the producer at the very end. And there's a lot of beekeepers that sell in the open market and they lose that connection because they sell it to the broker and they don't see it after that fact. But I can see it. I can see it being packed. I can see it being marketed. I can see it on the shelf. And I can see the consumer grabbing that honey and using it. And I really appreciate that because I put a lot of pride behind my product and a lot of energy. And I like to see my product represented on the shelf with the dignity it deserves, right? I know it's not being adulterated. I know it's not being mixed off. I know it's being sold to the consumer the way that I would be selling my own honey out of my honey house here. So things are working pretty well for us here.
Yeah, that is really awesome. I mean, and I think about when I think of things like that, I think about what great lessons that those pass along to our kids, you know, to be able to say, hey, look, see all the hard work and look at everything we do every single day. And here's the end product. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And I hear a lot of beekeepers that they'll criticize honey on the shelf, honey on the retail shelf, as being garbage honey. And every single time I'll point out to them, I say, no, that honey on the shelf that you're identifying here from one of those major chains is 100% Canadian honey, 100% from your backyard here within the area. These retailers are displaying that product with the dignity it deserves. And if you have a problem with honey or how it's being displayed, you need to take it to your retailer and figure out what's going on and push that campaign forward. And I think that's one thing that Canada is doing a better job at right now, is providing more of traceability, or maybe that's not the right word, but the consumers are demanding quality, and they're not demanding, you know, organics or anything like that, but they're demanding authenticity, and they're making sure that the products they buy on the shelf are actually what's being described in the label. And the retailers are hearing that, and they're then going and making sure they're sourcing products that can then meet that demand. And that's very important, I think, and that's driven from the consumer itself. And I think that attitude needs to be passed on and maybe adopted further down into other jurisdictions, like in the States, maybe, or throughout other places in the world. It's ultimately the consumer that decides what should be on that shelf. And if we can provide them with that quality product, the consumer is going to be happy. So as beekeepers, instead of criticizing broadly based accusations like that, I think we need to be careful and we need to be able to manage our own narrative and say, hey, yeah, you know what? You can buy local from the beekeeper, but also we can provide that local beekeeper product on the shelf and provide that same service to the consumers all the same. And we're proving that with BeeMade. We're doing that exactly with BeeMade. And that's one of the reasons why BeeMade's been able to hang on to their contracts right across Canada and these major chains, competing against this offshore crap coming in, just because a consumer is demanding authenticity, and we can guarantee that. Yeah. I kind of strayed off your comment there a little bit, so take that with a grain of salt.
Well, that's great. You know, honestly, we could probably have a 2-hour discussion on that topic alone, because it's a big deal. You know, and with all I don't want to say counterfeit, but you basically have entities throughout the world who've been banned from being able to export their honey into the U.S. because they're cheating, right? They're putting in corn syrup and other kinds of things to fake the system so they can give us something that's inferior. And
and it's all about public trust. I mean, as soon as you lose the public trust, you lose your marketplace, and then you all of a sudden open up your marketplace to absolutely everybody else who doesn't care about public trust, right? And that's something we need to do as producers, is embrace that public trust and capitalize on it. So as soon as our cooperative, we're in just a unique position. We know we have 100% Canadian honey because we are Canadian beekeepers. We are marketing our honey, and we can market almost from the beehive right to the consumer on the retail shelf in these major chains. We have that ability to make that track. We're tapping into the public trust, and they're rewarding us for it. And it's a beautiful thing. And I think that's what more of agriculture needs to do. And I'm not saying that the United States should just be only U.S. honey, or Japan is only Japan honey. I'm just saying the product that we're producing, to make sure we can back it up with authenticity, so we can, sell into markets like Japan. They know they're buying a wholesome Canadian product that hasn't been adulterated, that's been produced by that beekeeper over there, and then enjoy that product same down in the States, and vice versa. We can enjoy American products up here, knowing that, yes, this comes from those producers down there. We know how it has been produced and all the steps involved in producing it, and we can enjoy that product up here too. So it's just being able to prove the authenticity and prove that the quality hasn't been adulterated. I think we're going to be able to tap into a much larger thing than that we can really appreciate.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think you hit the nail on the head across multiple aspects of that, without a doubt. Well, now, and the great thing too, is that my number two listener group is Canada as a country. So it's good to, again, having you on is great, because we do have a lot of listeners up there. As you know, there are some core fundamental skills in beekeeping, that they really don't change wherever you live, but how you manage your colonies year round is vastly different. And we touched on this earlier. So as an example, folks down in Florida and in the South here, they don't have to do a whole lot to winterize their bees. But, as you have mentioned before, all of yours are indoors. So this is why, I encourage all new beekeepers, because this is the primary, target demographic and group that we're trying to reach with this podcast. And I tell them, look, join a local bee club, find a local mentor, someone in the area who can kind of show you the ropes, help you learn the things that are specific and unique to doing things, in your geographical area. So, with all that, being said, what types of recommendations would you have? Because there are so many listeners up in Canada, what would you say would be a good kind of overwintering strategy, things to consider? I've told people I had a winterization podcast. I think it was about 2 podcasts ago, and it was very high level and generic. But one of the big things I focused on is wet bees are dead bees. If you allow condensation to get into the hives, drips down on the bees, they get wet, they get cold, and they die. But, from your perspective, you're in the cold, and I'm thinking, honestly, in a few years, maybe moving up to Montana or getting, probably closer to you all. So what types of things do the beekeepers in Canada, in the northern U.S., or any cold climate, what are the considerations you guys have to take that might be unique and different from the folks in the South?
Yeah, that's a pretty loaded question. I think what I'll start with is, a guy you should talk to, a very interesting fellow, Corey Stevens. He's a VSH producer out of Missouri. And he told me one time, just within his breeding program, he says when they're working through pulling out traits that are favorable and stuff like that. He said, there's no advantages or disadvantages. There's trade-offs. And so you got to look at everything as being a trade-off. You're going to gain something, you're going to lose something. You're going to lose something, you're going to gain something. So he says, you just got to be able to balance those trade-offs to build, achieve something that's desirable and something that's workable for you. So when we kind of look at how we want to manage our bees to manage the conditions that are around us, we have to acknowledge that we have to focus on all of these advantages, but we also have to focus on the disadvantages. What balance kind of fits the skew, right? So I'm looking at my area in southern Manitoba, and what do we have here? We have long, cold, snowy, windy winters, and that makes just about an impossible environment to winter bees outside. But not, because I know a lot of beekeepers who winter outside, right? So they set themselves up appropriately. But as me as a beekeeper, I'm identifying all these disadvantages and trying to manage those. So what I've done is I've taken my bees and removed them from the external climate, all those conditions, and I moved them inside to shield them from that. A very effective strategy to move them inside. But because I did that, also now I have this whole big heap of problems that are associated with that. Even though, you know, I've managed all those other disadvantages, the trade-off was now I have those other heap of disadvantages I now have to deal with. So I just have to kind of balance the whole act, whether or not this that my management practice is actually beneficial or not beneficial. The guys who winter outside right now, they don't feel that managing indoors is beneficial because they just don't want to manage those other sets of problems that it is influenced onto them. So I guess what I'm saying is very specific. The way we manage our bees are not only specific to the area and environment around us, but it's very specific to us. How do we want to manage these bees? How do we want to approach these challenges and then work through all these issues to be able to be successful in their craft? So it's a hard answer to, you know, answer. You can't really outright answer it because there is no answer. Just how do you approach the situation of wintering? So when I'm looking at this winter, it's cold, windy, snowy. I remove them from those conditions. I'm moving them indoors, and that provides them in a little bit more of a static environment, very consistent. So I'm targeting consistency. I'm targeting the temperature within the hive. Like 4 degrees seems to be that magical number where the bees consume, or I guess you could say the most efficient at wintering throughout. And it also sets up the environment where the bees can set themselves up in this state of trance, because there's not a lot of variability. They can just set themselves up into this cluster and just kind of zone out for a couple of months and help prolong their life until it gets into spring. And it provides a huge advantage that way. I think outweighs more of the disadvantages. By bringing them inside like that, now I have to monitor the conditions in that shed. So it has to be 4 degrees, like I said. I have to provide air exchange to remove humidity because we don't want it too humid inside, and CO2. CO2 is very debatable, but just managing those conditions. The biggest problem probably is keeping them cool enough. Managing indoors is we kind of approach the complete opposite strategy as managing outside. You think about managing outside, you're trying to keep them warm, you're packing them up, you're trying to reduce that heat loss and helping them conserve their energy. While managing indoors, all of a sudden we have to think it completely opposite. We have to keep them cool. We have to keep them in a state where they're not too active and not consuming too much, and trying to keep them in their box, because if they get too warm, they'll start leaving their box and have high losses. So, you know, it's completely opposite. So we do that by using the advantage we have through winter is this cold, consistent air temperature outside. We just pump that cold air through the shed to try to pull that temperature down in the shed to maintain those very static conditions. Like, we've had a cold winter so far. I'm just looking outside and we're in another snowstorm, windy as heck. It's not that cold, but the end of tomorrow night it's going to be minus 30 again. It's been a very cold winter. That shed, I'm pumping air through continuously, just ventilation. My minimum air exchange would be kind of like a table fan on medium. So there's always air coming through. It ramps up when the shed warms up so I can pull more hot air out. But those bees inside that shed can keep, I have a 40 by 45 shed, 12 foot ceiling, 1,616 colonies in there. And I can keep that shed at 4 degrees Celsius through minus 35 weather in a week long process. It's just an amazing thing. And every one of these colonies are kicking off like 20 or 25 watts of heat energy at all times. And just a tremendous amount of energy. And, you know, that's what they use to heat themselves. And this is something that we have to manage now. We moved them indoors. So you're trying to manage that heat now and keep them all calm and collected and cool inside the shed. So that's my approach. You know, you take my approach and you try to transpose that onto somebody maybe in Alberta, even in Alberta, you, or let's say Montana, let's say you're going to be keeping Montana. You try to mimic what I'm doing up here. You can do it very successfully, except you get warm spells through the winter and that rise in temperature just makes it that much more difficult to keep your bees indoors. You know, that trade-off is you got to manage that heat production in that shed. And if you can't do it without door air temperature, you start having to realize you have to bring in other steps to cool the sheds down, like refrigeration. And you notice down beekeepers in Idaho or Iowa and like that, who are using potato cellars to winter some of the bees before they go to California, they have to use refrigeration units to be able to keep their bees cool. But that disadvantage doesn't outweigh the advantage that's being presented to them by moving them indoors, just by keeping them, you know, shutting them down, keeping them kind of static, and just helping them prolong that long life bee as far as they can, as low activity as possible. So I hope that provides feedback that you're looking for.
No, it does. You know, there's a lot more moving parts to it than I thought in my mind. In my mind, it's, you know, you've got a forklift, we're rolling them in, we're going to set them in here, we pull away, we drive off and just come back in the spring. I mean, not quite that simple, but, you know, relatively, you know, set it and forget it kind of thing. But obviously, like you said, there's a lot of active monitoring, a lot of that goes into it, even with that approach, right? It's not going to be like easier way to go.
And indoor beekeeping doesn't mean, a lot of beekeepers will get the misimpression that you can bring colonies that are maybe in trouble and get them through winter. It doesn't mean that at all. You have to follow all the same fundamental basics as you would wintering outside. They have to have almost zero mites on them. They have to be healthy, well-fed, good queens. All those same basics have to follow suit as you're wintering indoors, because they'll fall apart indoors just the same way they'll fall apart outdoors. It's just as providing us the ability to control the conditions, to be able to provide us the ability to predict a little bit more on their ultimate outcome coming out of the shed, maybe focus on more efficiencies like feed consumption efficiencies, and not and maybe, you know, sometimes you have some extremely variable late season weather that comes through, and that can really hammer outdoor colonies because it sets them on their head. By putting them inside, you're shielding them from those variable conditions, and you can maybe manage those variable conditions a little more effectively. And the other reason why I winter indoors is because I hate trapping beehives. You know, when you get into beekeeping, my philosophy is you find all the things you hate and you focus on that to remove that hate from the craft, because otherwise you're just going to hate your job all the time. So wrapping beehives is one of the jobs I hated, because you're always, you know, on the farm are busy. So I always left the wrapping till the end of the job. And as always, either snowing or half raining and you're cold and your fingers are frozen and you're trying to wrap these colonies up and mice get into your wrap and make a mess and it stinks and bees are cranky and they're still, even though it's cold, they're coming out and nipping you at the face. It's just miserable job, you know. I'd much rather go with my easy loader, go pick them up, put them on the truck, forklift them into a row, close the door, and be done with it already. So there's a lot of reasons why we choose our certain management practices. And like I say earlier, some of those reasons are personal. So we just deal things the way we see most appropriate.
That's so funny, you know, and I tell people all the time, I say, you know, if you hear people who are, you know, large scale commercial operations talking about the way they do things, it's great informational. It's good to know. It's good to understand their perspective, lots of information they can provide. But just keep in mind, too, that not everything that you are going to do is going to be the same thing they're going to do, and vice versa. You know, the idea of going and wrapping 1600 colonies, that's pretty laborious. That's pretty time intensive. So you know, I always tell people, like, yeah, just because it works in one scenario doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Now, you're overwintering in like single 10 frame deeps, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and nukes. I have some 5 frame and 6 frame nukes in the shed also.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, you know, you touched on something that leads me into the next topic I wanted to get into with you. You mentioned, hey, these bees got to be healthy. Varroa counts, you know, mite counts have to be low.
You know, absolutely.
Yeah, with, you know, disease and what they refer to, you know, IPM or integrated pest management in the beekeeping world. Everybody's heard of Varroa and treatments like Apivar and oxalic acid and so forth. And, you know, I'm always contending with, you know, the small hive beetle and wax moth. And, you know, there's always something. But, you know, American foul brood, European foul brood, chalk brood, Nosema, the list goes on and on. And what I would ask of you is, you know, what's the biggest kind of pest issue that you're dealing with up in Canada? And what recommendations would you have to newer beekeepers? You know, we try to teach them early on, here's what normal looks like. You don't have to know exactly what's wrong. You just need to be able to recognize that something's different or that something is wrong. But, you know, how would you respond to that? What do you think would be the best way to kind of, you know, tell a new beekeeper, this is the stuff you should be doing and maybe things you should look out for and how you should handle and manage some of those things?
Yeah, as being a cattle producer, I'm a big believer in keeping good animal husbandry. So by looking after your problems is very important. Like, you look at a cattle farm, for instance, if there's a problem, or let's say you have a 100-head cattle farm and you have a 10-head cattle farm just a mile down the road, what happens on that 10-head cattle farm or what happens on that 100-head cattle farm doesn't really influence each other very much because they're very contained within their separate little operations. So the management between those two practices doesn't really matter to each other, but in beekeeping it does, because we have to appreciate that our bees fly and the bees are opportunists. So they'll go and they'll tap in for some, you know, it just shows you how precious the honey resource is to bees, because they'll go through great lengths and take tremendous risk to rob it out of a dying, sickly colony to bring it back to their own, ultimately infecting their own colony just to get their fingers on those resources, you know. And that is just it. When you have a colony that is suffering or maybe failing because of disease, it leaves the opportunity open for other colonies within a 2 mile radius or however far they'll fly to go into that colony, rob out the resources, but then take all that problem and spread it out to all the rest of the colonies around them. A huge issue. And as new beekeepers, I think they need to appreciate that what they do directly relates to everything else that's going on around them, and vice versa. What's going on around them is influencing to what they're doing there. So animal husbandry is number one. First off, you got to learn your diseases. And especially, like, besides all else, American foul brood is probably the worst one just because of its context. You get American foul brood in, the bees have just such a terrible time trying to clean it up that it just takes colonies down and the bees can't deal with it. So ultimately, the best thing to do with those colonies is you have to burn them. There's nothing around that. It's just the best thing you can do is just start from scratch. And if a colony is going down with American foul brood, it infects all the rest of the colonies around them. And it just, you know, infection can just fester and spread like that. So you have to be aware with that. My biggest point of advice that I can give to new beekeepers is, like you mentioned, mentors. Find somebody that you trust that'll come in to give you, you know, a little bit of advice. And don't be intimidated to have someone else look at your colonies and point out issues, because it's very important that if there's an issue going on that you can recognize it and then accept assistance to be able to deal with that problem. And maybe if it's not another beekeeper because you're intimidated because you know how things are, reach out to your state or provincial apiarist. And that is their job. Their job is to come in there and help you identify and deal with these issues. And if it's American foul brood, they're going to tell you, you got to burn that colony, then you burn that colony, because that's ultimately the best thing you can do for all the bees within that area. Now, the other thing is Varroa mite, and it spreads exactly the same way. I mean, those little buggers are hitchhiking on bees and they're spreading between hive and hive and hive and drifting between all the colonies around. So you have infection, even though if you think you're controlling your Varroa mite infection within your nest, your bees could still be going out to a neighboring colony that is crashing because of row mite, and then ultimately bring those mites back into your yard. And I find that with my operation, I think I'm doing very well with my mite control. And all of a sudden I find this pocket just kind of flare up on me. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? My treatment's not working. Well, it's not necessarily treatments aren't working. It's probably reinfestation from outside colonies that is polluting what's going on in there. So because of that, we have to incorporate within our treatment regime, we have to incorporate monitoring. And that's probably one of the most important things that a beekeeper can do, is just continually monitor and assess the situation at hand. And then once you can, you know, measure the situation that's happening, you can better act and react to certain circumstances that fall in your lap. I don't like talking about types of treatments and treatment regimes, because everything is very specific to your audience, like wherever you are. There's different requirements that have to be followed in the States as there is in Canada, or even if you have viewers in Europe, there's different, you know, it's all regulatory, so I can't really speak on that. But just having the grasp of the situation at hand is probably the most important thing you can do. And I'd even extend that to, I know there's a lot of different philosophies within our craft. You have beekeepers who are more commercial that are will adopt treatment practices, maybe chemical treatment and such. And then there's also other beekeepers who are more naturalists, where they feel that bees can, you know, fend for themselves. They don't want to use treatments, and they want to keep things as natural as possible. I don't have any problem with that, with the natural aspect of it, as long as that beekeeper monitors, and as long as that beekeeper knows the situation at hand. And if there is a situation at hand, as long as they then deal with it. And if they want to deal with it through treatments or chemicals and such like that, they have to identify the problem and not allow that problem to be spread amongst everybody else around them. And, you know, if their colony is sick and dying, they're not ready to treat it, maybe they should just kill that colony off so it doesn't do any more damage than it already is doing, right? So there's a lot to do with this. And the best thing is knowing. And, you know, and the other best thing is just understanding and just kind of put that together and try to manage the bees in a respectable manner.
So I really like your explanation kind of better than mine, specific to like the holistic beekeeping kind of approach, because I've had several people who have said, well, I'm not going to use chemicals. And this is, and I've said, look, just because I kind of said bees aren't going to survive in the wild without treatment. I mean, essentially, varroa is out there. It's going to lock on. And if those bees aren't getting some kind of care treatment, you know, unless they have some kind of a inherited resistance to varroa, which I've heard there's mixed stories about that. But in the absence of having some type of resistance to varroa, I said, if you are not providing treatment to your bees, you're going to be creating this massive breeding ground for varroa until it kills your colony and how many others around you. But I think your explanation of saying, I understand that you don't want to treat with a chemical and you want to be more holistic, and that's fine, but you have to make sure you're monitoring and taking appropriate action. And that's the part I think maybe a newer beekeeper might struggle with. They're brand new to everything anyway, and now they're trying to get into some of these more advanced things. Okay, here's how you do an alcohol wash, and here's what you're looking for. Yeah. And, but yeah, I think that was a great point you made there. And then
the thing is, just because their colonies look healthy, and just because they don't want to carry forward with certain beekeeping practices, and it looks like that you're successful and you have this little breeding program going on and you're going to, you know, breed this mite resistant bee, that will be completely wiped off the map just by reinfestation from a neighboring beekeeper around you whose colonies maybe are having trouble infest your colonies, and they will die anyways just because of the influx of disease. And that's just the very nature of infection, is you have a flare up and it spreads. And if we're not able to prevent that spread, it's just going to, you know, explode into, you know, eruption of disease and just spread more, right? So even though you have something really cute going on, doing this little breeding project, you'd still have to realize all those outside factors will just completely minimize everything you're doing just by the very act and very nature of bees. So in a way, we have to accept that. And if we can't accept that, then I guess we're all done for.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it goes to commercial beekeepers too. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm being hard on small guys, because there's a lot of big commercial beekeepers that do not put enough attention towards the husbandry of their hives. And it becomes, my argument isn't so much to the big beekeeper because they have so much on the line that they put a lot of attention towards it. My argument isn't to the small beekeeper because they really only have a few colonies. Like, what damage can it really do? My argument more so is to those mid-sized beekeepers. I think those guys should be our target in trying to reach those mid-sized beekeepers. I was one of them at one time. You used to have 10 hives. Now you've grown to 250 hives. You have a job on the side. You have all this work to do. You can't get your work done because of your job. You start falling behind, you know, and then all of a sudden, instead of just one colony, like a hobby guy, you have 250 colonies that are spreading this disease all over the place, and it becomes more of a problem. So as these beekeepers are growing in size, they're following that ambition, that spirit to make something into something, you know, exciting, building a business. I want to be a full-time beekeeper. Oh, they have such a hard time making that transition because I can't spend enough time with those colonies as they build that workload out because they have that supplement job on the hand, and things just absolutely fall apart on them because they're not on top of husbandry. So as those beekeepers, we have to target them, and we have to send a message out to you guys that as you're building that operation, keep on top of those, that husbandry. That is job number one. Because if you can't control your husbandry, not only are you going to be a problem to everybody else around you, but you are going to completely fail as an operation, and you won't be able to stage out into something more exciting than what you built there. So that's just my message to beekeepers. We got to be careful on pegging demographics like that, right?
Sure, sure.
Because it's a problem for everybody. But at the same time, we have to focus in on what is the actual issue here. It's not the hobby beekeeper. I mean, seriously, it's the guys that just don't have the time to be able to put into their colonies and look after the issue. You know, we have to make sure we look after husbandry. Job number one is husbandry of our hives.
No, great point. Absolutely.
Every woman knows the feeling, that quick glance over your shoulder in a parking lot, the moment you grip your keys a little tighter walking home. That's exactly why She's Birdie created Birdie 3.0, a personal safety alarm designed by women for women. Just pull the pin and Birdie sounds a loud, attention-grabbing siren. We are talking as loud as a jet engine at 100 feet to help deter danger and alert people nearby. And the new Birdie 3.0 is even better. It's rechargeable, includes a built-in flashlight, and features an on and off switch, so it activates only when you want it to. No embarrassing false alarms. It's small, non-violent, travel safe, and easy to clip to your keys, bag, or backpack, so it's always within reach. It's also super cute and comes in tons of colors to match basically any outfit, so you actually want to have it on you, because everyone deserves to feel safer. Learn more and get your Birdie 3.0 today at cheesebirdie.com.
It's funny how as you're talking, I can see like four or five other things that keep popping up, and I'm like, okay, I gotta rein this in, or we'll be here all day.
We are beekeepers. We tend to talk and talk and talk.
You know, it's funny. I'm mentoring a gentleman who's local, and we got on the phone the other day, and like I took one deep breath, and I think I talked for about 25 minutes straight, and I got to the end, and I was like, I'm sorry, man. I get a little excited about this, so it happens.
Yeah. I make a rule because I'm on YouTube now, and I have a lot of exposure, I guess. And guys will phone me, and I used to pick up the phone and then be just kill an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I was like, I can't do this. So I make a rule to myself now that I can't pick that phone up. You know, even though I want to, and even though I want to be polite and talk to beekeepers, I can't do it because it just kills my day. So I say, okay, guys, I'm not talking to you on the phone. Give me an email. You know, I answer all my emails kind of short form if I have to, but it's just, you know, it's overwhelming.
Well, you know, I think the plan maybe moving forward is just you gather up all the emails once a month, you jump on with us, you know, you run through everything. We put all the information out there, and then you don't have to worry about calling everybody back. You can just knock it out in one big, you know, 2 hour call, and we'll do it that way.
Yeah. It's managing workload, right?
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. Hey, you know, speaking of workload, I noticed you have this pretty awesome system. This is getting more to the hands-on piece of things, but I saw your truck with the boom and the fork, like the pallet forks on it. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Cause that's a pretty awesome piece of machinery.
Oh yeah. That's comes from Australia. It's an easy loader. Just kind of like a boom jib crane is what it is. Articulating is got, it can reach anywhere out 16 feet out. Lifts, it won't lift a barrel, honey. I think sometimes they say it will, but I won't test that. But I just need it to be able to lift 5 or 6 full boxes of honey. And I bought that, like I was talking earlier, about templates. When I first got into beekeeping, I followed much the same process as much everybody else. Is, you know, you have your four-way pallets and you hire a crew of guys and you have a forklift and pallets. And I just got tired of dragging forklifts around. And I didn't solve the actual awkward lift that I was trying to solve, which is lifting heavy honey boxes off a colony. No matter how many forklifts you have in the yard, unless you relieve the problem with hiring more guys, you're still lifting those heavy boxes of honey off the colonies. And it's not an easy lift. Like, this is over our heads. And sometimes we're twisted and we're bending over, and it's just killed my back. So I was looking for a solution to that. And my neighbor had one of these things, and I kind of looked to see what he was doing. And it's an expensive little piece of machinery. So I sat down. Dad told me, well, he said, I might as well invest into your back now when it's good than when you have it buggered up. So sure. He lent me a little bit of money, kind of like on a work loan, I guess you can call it. So we bought this crane. And with that crane, I then developed my entire operational strategy around it. So not only am I using it to help pull honey with the use of the skateboards, but I'd also set up my yards and two hive pallets, and I started moving all my colonies with it too, just to help make better payback for this unit. And as soon as I adopted that practice and switched my entire facility over to it, I haven't looked back. It's been quite a useful machine. And I, you know, a lot of the beekeepers will tell you it's pretty slow and maybe cumbersome, and you add a few more steps. So if you're looking to build an operation that is quick and efficient, you know, the best thing you can do is hire guys or buy a forklift. That's the best way to go about that. But my focus is more internal. I wanted to keep things more myself. I wanted to be able to hire kids from town. I mean, anybody who wanted a job on the farm, I could give them a job, because the basic requirement of lifting 80-pound boxes wasn't there anymore. So, you know, anybody want a job, I hire. I keep everything. I don't hire foreign workers. I don't need to, because I have enough workforce just locally here. I hire my own kids now, and I worry about wrecking their backs as we're working away. So it's just been such a nice addition to my overall management strategy. It becomes part and parcel. I can't, when the arm goes down, I'm scrambling because I don't want to lift boxes anymore. You know,
I tell you, it's no joke. When I talk to people, again, because I'm dealing with a lot of people who are very new, and I've said to them, look, ignore what you hear from everybody else. And you've hit the nail on the head, right? Don't do what's right for everyone. Do what's right for you and your situation. And yeah. I've told them, like, look, it's not common for somebody to make a brood chamber, as an example, with, you know, four shallows or, you know, but hey, if that's what you got to do, if that's what works for your bite, the bees are going to adapt. They're going to figure it out. They like to move vertically if they can. Outside of that, you know, don't make it something that's, you know, 40 frames wide. They're probably not going to like that. But outside of that, they're going to figure it out and they're going to make it work. And, you know, I mean, I remember when I was early into my beekeeping, I'm like, oh, I got three or four deeps. Let's just throw a bunch of deeps in there. And then you pull a deep off, loaded up with honey, you know, with just packed full of honey. You do that twice and you're like, okay, that's a bad idea. Right. And
yeah, and that's pretty taxing on the back.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. And a lot of the beekeepers I'm seeing and people that I'm engaging with, there are kind of, it seems to be these folks who are probably like mid to late 40s into about 60. There, a lot of them are kind of, they're getting ready to retire from their full-time job. They're looking for, you know, a new hobby. And I know me, I'm 48. And I mean, I can tell you right now, with my back and the way I've messed it up in the past already, I physically cannot. It's not an option for me. So I've got a little, you know, Kubota tractor and I've got forks on it, and I can, you know, and that's great. And I certainly, you know, one day when I grow up, I definitely want to have that same system you have. But I think at this point in time, I don't think I can justify that expense.
And that's just it right there. You just said it right there. Justify. That's the hardest thing with incorporating something like the Easy Loader, because you're kind of going out of the mold a little bit. You have to justify the expense to yourself, and that's easy enough, but you then have to justify the process to your neighbors, because you're going to have everybody say to you, why the heck do you need that thing? It's too expensive. Do things this way, this way. And that's the hardest thing. And as soon as I was able to ignore that and justify to myself the purpose of investing into this alternative way of managing bees, I mean, then I was off in the races. But the hardest thing was making that justification. I know some beekeepers here who try to mimic what I'm doing, large beekeepers too. I know beekeepers who adopted it and haven't looked back like me. And I know other beekeepers who sold that arm the following year just because they couldn't justify that with their neighbors.
Sure, sure.
And I feel it goes with life. That's a lesson we have to kind of acknowledge as we work through all areas of life. But, you know, even with you're going to work mediums instead of doing the standard deep through your brood chambers, that's off the cue. You have to be able to justify managing in that certain arrangement. And as soon as you're comfortable with it, being able to explain your purpose to everybody else, then those have just become details, right? So justification is a huge issue.
Absolutely. So of all the day-to-day tasks that a beekeeper has and all the things that you do on a regular basis, what would you say are, I kind of got a heads up on this one earlier, but what are your most favorite and your least favorite things to do as a beekeeper?
Boy, you know, in the middle, at the back end of the honey pool, I hate bees. I hate everything to do with the business. Then you get into winter and we get a break up here because we put them into winter for 5 months or whatever. And we get a bit of a break from the bees and then you start talking about them again and you start looking forward to spring again. So a refresh, a break from this business is critical, is absolutely crucial because they just demand every aspect of your life. You know, I have how many in my shed right now? 95 million bees. And every one of those bees has a little whip. And they whip me all day long with that, right? I can't get away from them. So you have to be able to, that's a good question, because you have to be able to identify the aspects you like and what's kind of attracted you to the business. And you also have to be able to identify what you don't like and be honest with yourself. And if you can be honest with yourself and identify those things that you don't like, you can focus on all those attributes and then maybe bring something to relieve that dislike about it. And the more things you can take away that you don't like, just adds that much more pleasure to your overall management of the business. So, and that comes as you evolve through the business. Like what I liked and disliked when I had 500 hives is a lot different now than I have 1600 colonies going on now, because everything, the art of beekeeping is the same, but the processes are a lot different. So you start layering different processes, different demands, you know, restraints, rewards, and all that is a lot different. But right now, I think what I don't like, well, I hate robbing bees with a passion. If I could raise little, you know, breed little bees that didn't rob, then I'd be a much happier beekeeper. I hate robbing bees. I go through a lot, especially when you have a yard that's too close to the honey house and the guys leave the door open. You get punished for it and the workers get punished. And then you start, and as soon as robbing season starts, we have a pretty intense honey flow through the first part of summer. So we can get away with a lot of things up here, leave the doors open or whatever. I just manage bees a lot differently when bees aren't robbing. But as soon as the honey flow slows down a bit, and they step into that winter hoardy spirit and start robbing, you start following rules and you start making sure things are done a certain way. Otherwise, those little bastards will punish you. So, you know, pulling honey, you got to be quick in the yards. I would use skateboards, which leaves a stack of unprotected boxes on top so you have cracks. Either you tape them up or cover them up to make sure the bees don't take that honey back. Just that constant battle of robbing. Ooh, I hate that. The one thing I do like about beekeeping is one thing that's probably kept me in this business is just this unique connection it provides me to the environment, I guess. I wouldn't call myself an environmentalist, but being tied directly to agriculture, like we are a substantial farm here, we're very conservative-minded, conservation-minded is what I mean. Just our landscape is extremely variable with hills and valleys. We have some flat land that has sensitive type, salty type muskeg lands. And we manage our property according to its type. And we're very focused on the management of our soils because the soils that provide us our livelihoods. One thing I like about the bees is it allows us to tap into the conservation, that whole sense of conservation in a different way, not just basically on the soil, but more so on diversity and the importance of having a diverse landscape and makeup right across the countryside. And farmers don't appreciate that because we look at anything growing other than that crop or the pasture grass as being a weed. And we do that for good reason, but we need to realize that there's other things that need to exist at the same time. And that's something we don't appreciate because we're not connected to that sense of the environment needing that sense of diversity, except if you're a beekeeper. So I have a unique balance of being a grain farmer, cattle farmer, and a beekeeper. So I can see that need to be able to manage the land, manage the soils, manage the production. But at the same time, we need that diversity to be able to sustain our own honeybee operation, to be able to keep them well nourished. If these bees aren't well nourished, they can't collect that crop from that grain land, which we're growing every year. And that balance, right? We need to appreciate that what we do on our landscape is directly reflective to everything else that exists. And I think that's being lost amongst a lot of farmers is just that connection that we think we're achieving sustainable efforts, but we're missing a very important, crucial part, which is that act of diversity. And we need to be able to preserve that natural environment to allow things, not just bees, but natural pollinators, bumblebees, natural pollinators, other insects, other animals. We need a place to allow things to live. And we need to do a better job in just establishing that balance a little bit better.
You know, I absolutely love hearing that. I mean, that's one of the big things I think that drew me into beekeeping. You know, I started years ago kind of with a different beginning, but as I've, you know, acquired some land and I'm spending time on that land and I'm just getting more time, you know, out of the city, out of the suburban areas and just being just in it and immersed in it and recognizing that we have a massive impact on everything that's around us and we can do a lot more. And, you know, it's tough when you look around the world and you see, you know, the waterways are getting destroyed with pollution and waste runoff and all these, there's so many aspects to it to where you can say, well, at least I've got this one little piece I can be involved in that is making a difference. And there's that piece. I know you've experienced it because I've seen it in your videos before, but when you get outside and you've got thousands of bees flying around you right past your head and you're just like, wow, this is exciting. And
That's right on point. I'm so happy you said that. Just that little piece. If we just appreciate that, if we have just little pieces, but all over the place, those little pieces, and maybe this is sounding flaky, but those little pieces all over the place comes to something substantial. And that's all we need to be able to achieve is just those little aspects of preservation, which add up to something that is really noticeable, something that really contributes. And that can be done by absolutely everybody within society. If everybody really give a damn about, you know, our sustainable efforts and moving forward and, you know, recognizing our ecosystem and all that, just by shifting our habits, shifting what we do every day, just a little bit makes a huge difference. And if we relate that down to honeybees, just by providing little pockets of the natural world all over the place, I don't care where it is, just a little wetland that maybe doesn't have to be farmed, leave that alone, maybe put more effort into the ditch, allow natural growth as we try to manage these conditions, all these noxious weeds and bulrushes and water management, that if we put a little more effort into managing those issues, but then allowing other things to flourish, I mean, that's a huge resource for pollinators to, you know, thrive on. But at the exact same time, when I say all this and these efforts we need to do to be able to preserve the landscape, my narrative also goes directly back to beekeepers and to environmentalists saying that we need to appreciate the act of development at the same time because we need to exist. There's a reason why we're growing these crops. It's because we need to eat and we want all these luxuries in life. So we have this act of development as we, you know, develop our societies and live. So we need to be able to allow development to happen. We can't, as beekeepers, tell that farmer not to farm his property the way it is because his hands are tied. You know, he's all economics. He's there managing the land best to his abilities, you know, making his livelihood on this and doing a very good job. He doesn't need a beekeeper to come by and say, you're doing this all wrong. Where's all these weeds? I need these weeds in your field because my bees are starving. Well, that just doesn't cut it. But if we go to these farmers and we appreciate what they're doing, and if we work with these farmers to maybe establish some of those little efforts all over the place, you know, those preservation around the edges, maybe, let's say, then maybe we can achieve the same thing where we can preserve the natural world, fortify our bees' diet, keep them healthy. And then as beekeepers, we can then also exploit this huge abundance of wealth, like these flowers that grow across Canada here. We can maybe pull that honey crop off and find that balance between the two. So, you know, we beekeepers, we have our foot in both doors. We're environmentalists in one way, but at the same time, we're also, we're a part of agriculture. We're a part of that whole system. We have to make sure that we don't alienate that aspect of our beekeeping craft. We have to make sure we contribute to agriculture at the same time. And maybe this is an opportunity where we as beekeepers can take this foot in the door and bring that sense of environmentalism into the beekeeping conversation a little more effectively, and maybe try to find these places where we can come together a little more effectively. So it's impossible. You look at my farm and I'm trying to balance this whole issue, and I'll never achieve it because there's always pressures on the grain side and development, and there's always pressures on the honeybee side where I have to respect that development, but we still need to sustain operations. And how can I manage my grain farm in certain ways within these constraints without like hopping on that sprayer, the 120-foot boom, and killing all the bugs within the landscape, right? How do I do that? Well, it doesn't mean that I don't do that. It means maybe I should do an extra few steps to mitigate the risks that action would put on the natural environment, aka my bees. You know, there's certain things, certain practices, certain strategies we can adopt to maybe help mitigate these issues, to help us come closer together and manage this impossible issue that we're faced with right now.
No, amen. I mean, I think maybe you missed your calling. I think maybe you could have been like a global agricultural advocate. I think you really, you know, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, there's so many things there that are just, as you're talking, I'm nodding. Yes, yes, yes. So now yeah. That's.
And it's a tough thing to convey because you don't want to sound flaky in one hand, and you don't want to sound like a cold-hearted developer on the other hand. It's an important, like, you can't have the best of both worlds. But like a business owner, there's no such thing as business personal life balance. It's a lie. You're always weighted to look after that business. The business controls your life, even though you want to pretend you have that balance of family. You got to be able to identify and then manage things accordingly to sustain things going forward. And for me, like for business wise, you know, I'm weighted 75% towards business and everything I'm doing here, and I only carve out 25% for myself and the family. That is what it has to be. That's what allows me to work, move forward. It's not a balance, but it's acceptable with my family. It's just the way it is. It's not a balance, but it's how I'm sustaining myself moving forward. And we might have to do the same thing as we recognize these issues within development and within the natural world. Is we're not going to be able to achieve that perfect balance. We're not going to be able to claim that imbalance that favors us. Maybe we can find pieces here and there that maybe favor us this way, maybe favors them that way. And when we bring it all together, then it becomes a workable format.
Without a doubt. Absolutely. It's that constant balancing act. And I agree. So one final, I feel like we could probably, you know, go for another hour. So I don't want to do that to you or I both, but one final question for you, Ian, is, you know, any parting words of wisdom, right? You got brand new beekeepers out there. And I would say right now we're going into my second season of the podcast. So we have people who were listening all last year and they're getting ready to start out this year. There were a few of them that jumped the gun. There are a few of them that are on the fence. You know, what would you say as sort of the just, in, you know, any words of wisdom, but primarily like the, hey, no matter what you do, never do this, always do this, whatever you can think of that might help them to kind of get off the fence and make the commitment and just give it a shot, or anything you can think of.
Yeah. One thing right off the start, and maybe a little more applied. This would be a conversation geared more applied, maybe to more your question. As any beekeeper, it doesn't matter if you're a small beekeeper or a large beekeeper, the best thing you can do as a beekeeper is, my advice is to build your bees and buy your boxes. And what that means is, if you're going to invest money, make sure you invest money into something tangible, something that you can grab a hold of, something that you can sell. I see way too many times beekeepers that get that bug, that ambitious spirit, and it leads them into thinking they want to be this beekeeper, and they go and invest, let's say, $50,000 into a whole bunch of bees because they want to be a 100-hive beekeeper or something like that. So they buy all of these bees, but they don't have the facility to support that, nor do they have the know-how to build to sustain those operations, and those bees die. And I hope they didn't have a loan against it, but if they do, all of a sudden they have this payment to make on nothing, right, except for empty boxes. So my piece of advice to beekeepers getting into the business or maybe growing their business is, if you're going to invest your money, build the equipment, build the facility, you know, invest your money into building the structure of your business, and then build your bees, like buy your facility, build your bees. And what that does is kind of measures your growth to your own capability. So if you build 100 boxes, let's say, and you had 10 colonies, it's going to take you a little while to build to then build those 10 colonies to fill those 100 boxes. And along the way, that just provides the sense of learning the craft. You know, if you make a mistake, it's not a whole bunch of invested money out. It's just a whole bunch of your time and effort out. And that's what beekeeping is. It's, you know, growing and contracting, growing and contracting. You got to make sure that when you grow, and ultimately when the bees punish you and you contracted, that contraction doesn't cost you money, capital money that you invest into that business. You got to make sure that that contraction is just a part of the business process, which can be absorbed very easily. So if, in a roundabout way, I guess it's just as simple as that. Buy your boxes, build your bees. That's the best thing you can do.
Well, Ian, I'll tell you, you know, like I said before, early on, and I've told you, I think, you know, by email that, you know, I've watched the YouTube channel, and it, you know, it's one thing to see the channel, but to be able to engage with you in this capacity and in this way, I recognize that you take great pride in yourself, in your farm, in your family, your craft, the trade. And, I mean, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out today. I know that this is going to, I get usually like, you know, a couple dozen emails in every episode. I know we're going to hear from some folks on this one, how much they enjoyed it. You are always welcome to come back if you have something, you know, fun or interesting you want to share. Or like I said, if you get tired of, you know, answering all those emails, you can always just come on here and answer them all on here. But no, we really do appreciate everything. And I wish you and your family the best, especially for this upcoming bee season here that's right around the corner. And, you know, don't be a stranger.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for that. I just love reaching out, communicating with beekeepers in this way. It's something that's not natural to me. I'm a very low-key kind of, I'm the guy that sits in the back corner of the conventions and doesn't really say much, just takes it all in. So me kind of pushing myself more and more to the front is very unnatural for me. But it's a real lot of fun connecting with beekeepers and just kind of exploring all these thoughts and such. And but if you, I'll make you a deal. If you have some listeners and they compile a list of questions or comments or whatever, reach out to me and do a kind of a shotgun approach to me next time. Just boom, 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 and you'll see what happens.
Sounds like a plan. We can make that happen. Well, Ian, thanks again. And everybody, it's Sepler Farms up there in Manitoba, Canada. And you can find him on the Canadian Beekeepers blog on YouTube. So that about wraps it up for this episode. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. Jeff@beekeepingfornewbies.com. And we will talk to everybody soon. Take care. Be kind to one another.
Can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on...
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.